Everyone has a story. How they got here, where they met along the way, the choices they made, the dreams they are chasing. Welcome to Anthologies of Hope. Welcome back to this week's Anthologies of Hope for our third amazing Wednesday interview, and one that is packed to the brim with great conversation. This definitely won't be the last time we hear today's guest on the podcast, and you'll hear why very shortly. As always, I'm your host, Rick Osowski, and I'm not a mental health professional in any way, simply a mental health advocate with a passion for storytelling. Thanks again for the great response from our episodes last week, both our Wednesday interview with Amanda Vetrano, walking through her journey of the loss of her sister and the founding of her nonprofit organization, the Learn for Lauren Foundation, and its mission to redefine self-care for everyone, as well as the Boys Don't Cry Conversations Cafe panel from the Hope for the Day Conversation Summit 2019. Keep that feedback coming. We'd also like to thank Untold Stories Recordings, as we recorded our conversation with Amanda in studio with them, as well as their awesome rescue work on the Boys Don't Cry panel's necessary post-production audio. Be sure to check them out on Facebook and Instagram at Untold Stories Recordings for all your local audio and studio needs. Be sure to check back over the next few weeks for a big announcement that is one I am very excited to share with all of our listeners. And if you've been listening over the last few weeks, this new announcement isn't anything we have covered so far. But circling back to some of that additional content we have covered, we are looking to launch our blog next week to bring you excellent writing from past guests and friends of the show. That will be kicking off with an initial blog series titled Eureka, based on inspiration from one of my favorite Comic-Con artists, Monkey Minion Press, and their excellent art book titled Eureka, The Art of Science. Check them out on Instagram at Monkey Minion Press and their website at monkeyminionpress.com to get a head start. Continuing the excellent Conversations Cafe content, we'll keep those episodes rolling every Friday, both from Sip of Hope Coffee Bar and Hope for the Day's Conversation Summit 2019. This Friday's episode will cover the intersectionality and mental health panel from the Conversation Summit. On the few weeks when there is not any Conversations Cafe content on Fridays, we will be bringing you a new episode format for this season, the Mental Health Minute episode. The shorter episodes will start hitting the airwaves on a few Fridays in November, covering practical, research-proven tips on how you can approach your mental health care delivered in a conversationable and actionable approach, starting with two separate episodes to focus on skills and techniques for anxiety and depression, respectively. These mental health episodes will be accompanied with blog posts of their own, so you can take away concrete courses of action whenever you may need them. Again, a big announcement over the next few weeks, blog starting most likely next week, and Mental Health Minute episodes in about a month. And now on to this week's guest. Casey Ryan joins us today, and she's our first guest that sought us out to make an appearance on Anthologies of Hope, and it is one that I am very grateful that she did. As you'll hear in the interview, this is only a portion of what we wanted to talk about and could have kept going for another hour or more. So I hope to circle back with Casey in the future for a part two of our awesome conversation. Anthologies of Hope is all about stories and journeys, and Casey's is one that I'm proud to share with everyone. We jump into an overview of Casey's background, beginning with alcohol and drug addictions at the ages of 13 and 15 respectively, treatment and recovery of those addictions, as well as mental health issues through the standard process of care in the American recovery system, as well as how she transformed her life to thrive in corporate America, only to leave that behind to empower others with her own life coaching expertise. We talk about the downfalls of the current addiction recovery movement in the United States, how it fails to address both addiction and uniquely disparate mental health issues at the same time, as well as the existence and impact of mental health stigmas in the workplace. As you can hear, that's quite a lot to cover in the 90 minutes we've got in this episode, so be sure to check out Casey's guest page at anthologiesofhope.com/guest/Casey-Ryan after the episode for all her contact info, her coaching website, and the link to the Self-Made and Sober podcast appearance we mentioned in this episode for more details on Casey's background. Of course, as it is a new season, we will be starting a new Spotify playlist to join in with all of our long-form interviews. You can check it out now at anthologiesofhope.com/playlist, and it is all the songs associated with the first half of Season 3 right now. You can still find Season 1 at anthologiesofhope.com/season-1-playlist, and Season 2 at anthologiesofhope.com/season-2-playlist. Every week, we'd like to remind you that if you're in a time of crisis, we will be covering a range of potentially difficult topics. Please use this as a warning to seek help and come back to listen once you're in a more positive season. If you are in need of help, an abundance of international resources can be found on the Find Help pages from Trait Love in Our Arms and Hope for the Day. Trait Love in Our Arms can be found at twloha.com/find-help, and Hope for the Day can be found at hftd.org/find-help. As always, you can find us at anthologiesofhope.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Anthologies of Hope, on Twitter as Anthologies Pod, or email us directly at anthologiesofhope, all one word, no punctuation, at gmail.com. Like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, or wherever else you're finding this very podcast. So without further ado, this week's guest on Anthologies of Hope, a resilient spirit with more than enough energy to fill any room she's speaking in. Life coach and mental health advocate, Casey Ryan. So we're here with Casey Ryan, who is a life coach, and I'm very much interested in digging into all the aspects of that and kind of what, how that pertains to everything we've talked about on Anthologies of Hope with mental health and all the aspects of that, but also with addiction and addiction recovery. And as we were just talking off mic, you said usually when you're on a podcast, it's talking about a lot of your backstory, and that kind of takes up a lot of the time, but we wanted to be a little bit more forward-looking in talking about all the links to addiction recovery and mental health and some of that stuff. So you were on another podcast recently when I did some of my research beforehand, where you, it looked like you delved into a lot of your backstory there, and that was called Self-Made and Sober. Yes. So that would be a good one to check out for folks that if you're interested in hearing more of the backstory that we don't cover probably in its entirety as we're going to talk here, that would be a good place to talk. So why don't you go ahead and say hello, and then we'll jump into it.
Yeah. Hi everyone. I am Casey, and I'm here on Anthologies of Hope, and my mission to, when I had reached out to Rick, was that to talk about the correlation between mental health recovery or mental illness recovery and then addiction recovery as well, and how the two, mental health and just addiction, you just go so much hand in hand, and the struggles that we face even before picking up drugs or alcohol, what we go through while we're using, and then really for me and a lot of my story and what I've seen over the years is the difficulty to really get the best and most beneficial comprehensive help when you're trying to get sober, when you've also, like in my case, you know, dealt with a diagnosed mental illness. And it's almost like, you know, what do you do first? Mm-hmm. You know, the chicken or the egg, what do we treat first here? And really just the struggle of that. And then also one of the other reasons that I had reached out to speak on this topic was watching friends over the years of my sobriety and being in recovery who had passed away, who had taken their own life. And then in hindsight, it's just really wondering, you know, it's almost like labeled as an overdose in mm-hmm. the addiction recovery community. But, you know, always wondering, was it intentional? Was it not intentional? Knowing that they had battled with, you know, maybe chronic depression or bipolar, and that they were really just trying to quiet the mind, and we label it as an overdose, and just how defeating I really found that, and just how it really did it. The best way I could say it is that it doesn't do any justice for the addiction recovery community, and it doesn't do anything for the, you know, for mental illness recovery, because no one wants to talk about mm-hmm. it. So that was really, you know, that was the mission, to reach out here, you know, just express, you know, my personal experience, and then to reach out to people who either are dealing with a family member that's going, or living with a family member that's, you know, going through this, or if you've been through this yourself, that hopefully you can relate and know that there's a lot more to talk about when it comes to these two separate but very much intertwined fields.
It's very interesting as we'll jump in through all of that, and I'm very grateful you're the most prepared guest we've had so far. So that's awesome, bringing some of your notes here. So I'm very interested to jump into all of it. It's also interesting, we just had Megan Tress not too long ago, where she's a nurse practitioner coming into it, talking about just exactly what you were saying there, where there tends to be most of the medical community or a lot of the officials in the community wanted to just be like an open and shut case and just kind of wipe their hands of something and move on, as opposed to having a conversation about the person, kind of delving into the agency and autonomy that they had in everything that they were doing, and then seeing if there was more to the story there, as opposed to just labeling it overdose, labeling it XYZ, and kind of moving on and just trying to get as many people, cases, paperwork through the door as possible. So we talked at length about that. So it'll be interesting to see how these conversations kind of pair up against each other.
Yeah, even since you just mentioned her, I thought about this as I was looking at notes of just all of these things that I wanted to talk about. And then having to remind myself where it's like, I need to preface in any way, shape, or form. It's like, I'm not licensed in this. I don't have all of the magical answers. None of us do. And, you know, so when it comes down to what is the proper course of treatment, you know, I don't have like a definite answer for that. If I did, I'd probably really, really promote it and say, this is it. But it, you know, just like anything, especially when it comes to, you know, a mental health or like a diagnosed mental illness, we know, as it, you know, at this point, we know very little in the grand scheme of things. So, and I did, I was like, you have to preface, I'm not a professional in this. I just have a lot of years of experience of being in the recovery community. And then, you know, with my practice of coaching and, you know, and having friends that have experienced a lot of stuff, especially in the past decade, about where these, you know, people really making money off of addiction. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, when they're doing that, just like you had just kind of said right there, where it's like almost just checking the boxes and like getting them out. And that's something that I have in my notes, where there's so much more than, you know, the system is overloaded. Again, I don't have all the answers, but it's really just about wanting to get out and talk about this for people that are going through it or who have gone through it, to see like, we can just like with this podcast or like with Hope for the Day, it's like we can start that movement and say, I will not be, the best way I could put it is like, I will not be your guinea pig here. Mm-hmm. Because I suffer from something does not mean that I need to bow down before you and just take whatever you tell me or give me at face value. I am worth more than that. And to start that movement almost to say, I'm still this human being, even though I may not be exactly like you, mm-hmm. you know, I'm worth more than that. So yeah, you know, it's not 100% professional. As I was going through all of this, it was like, my gosh, there's more to talk about, to think about than what is even within the scope of the time that we have here, which was somewhat defeating. And then at the same time, very motivating yeah. to get out and talk about it more, to start these conversations, to get people thinking.
You mentioned it right there, where being not a licensed expert on the subject, but I mean, that's the foundation of Anthologies of Hope, is the lived experience of the individual. And when something comes up, when something goes wrong, who do you usually turn to? Your friends, family, loved ones, people you know that may have gone through something, or you may ask them first. And so that's kind of what this is, just in a nutshell, is sharing those lived experiences. And you have, and we'll kind of quickly delve into your background here in a moment, but that's really all it is. Like, you're not necessarily going to, like you just said, 1-800 doctors and be like, okay, yep, you said you gave me a diagnosis within 5 minutes, I'm good, I'm done, like I don't need to follow up with anything else. Like, it's like, no, like knowing what works for some people, what works for other people, what doesn't, and kind of moving through that is invaluable to all of our existence. And that's really the connection there between all the people sharing their stories on Anthologies of Hope is really why I was excited to have this conversation too.
You know, looking at that too, and I like what you just said, where it's, you know, calling up and who do we normally call, and, you know, having that conversation. I think that's the scary thing about talking about addiction or, you know, our mental health, and then people are afraid to engage in that conversation because they're like, well, I'm not a licensed professional. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, you're still a human being, and people just, they don't necessarily want advice. You know, they don't really want advice. They just want someone to like vomit their stuff yeah. out sometimes and like, and feel that emotional connection, feel their own energy of getting everything out. And whether whether the issue is resolved at that moment, that's really, at least in my case, you know, throughout my childhood, I'm like, I'm just looking for emotional connection. And really, you know, even if you do see a therapist or go to some sort of, you know, IOP or have help for substance abuse, that is finite to that time, depending on, yeah, your actual time or your monetary, you know, your limited, you know, funds. But friends, and there's a lot of other programs out there that are just almost endless. And it's just about having that human connection.
And so I want to be mindful of the time, since you said there was a lot you wanted to talk about, yeah. but you did go deep into your background and your upbringing and some of that on the Self-Made and Sober podcast. So we can reference folks there as well. But then also you have at least one blog post on your website, some more about it information there at ryanlifecoaching.com. That's correct?
Yes.
Okay. So then just some of the background that you gave me while we were scheduling some of this, but you suffered from childhood with severe depression and anxiety, and then you've been in active addiction recovery for 13 years, and in that time have become a life coach. And so I'm just paraphrasing. So anything that I don't get right, go ahead and correct me. But then you were also saying that you used addiction as a way to escape, but also made it twice as hard to get and sometimes stay sober. So just anything you want to jump on really quick there before we kind of take that off into the bent of being proactive and how to turn all this around into proactive mental health.
I was one of those that, and I kind of mentioned, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? And just because you have one, you know, whether you have, you know, a mental illness or your addiction comes first, one doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have, you know, like that.
It doesn't presuppose one or the other.
Yeah, this isn't the cause of it. For me, in my case, I remember I was depressed throughout like almost my entire life, to where by the time I was, you know, 8 or 9, like that was the norm. And I had I did one of those things where I was like, I tried to cut my wrist when I was about 10, I think. And I remember, and I told my mom, and it was like that cry for help. And she had brought me to a counselor where, you know, then it was diagnosed as depression, you know. And thinking about that now as an adult is very scary, where mm-hmm. that was just, you know, that was just the norm. And when I had the opportunity to engage in drugs and alcohol, it was that thing of you just want to fit in, just wanting that connection. You know, I won't go like too much into my childhood, but there were, you know, emotional abandonment issues, never physically abandoned or anything, but emotional abandonment issues, and just a lack of connection that way, of emotional and psychological connection. And that is something, that actual label of abandonment, emotional abandonment, I did not receive that or hear that until I was sober. And I was about 23 years old.
Oh,
and
wow.
I had started seeing a therapist. And when she said that to me, it was like that, you know, the clouds had opened up.
Yep.
And, you know, the Lord was shining down on me. And I was like, oh, you know, and that
it
I
all
had
makes
gotten
sense now.
It. And I thought, there's a label for me. And again, it was that connection. It was such a change in my life, because every day that I had lived up until that moment, I felt so alone and just unique. And to hear that there was, she just summed it up in two words. And I was like, I did. I felt like I fit in. It was better to know at that point than not to know, because it felt like my entire life, I had not known what was wrong with me. And when she said that, it was such a drastic change. And in that, it's better to know than to not know, no matter how difficult that, mm-hmm. you know, that term might be for some people. It was huge for me to find out, because that was part of that connection that I had made. I can't even say, like, I dabbled in drugs and alcohol, you know, when I started. It was like, I just dove like
right in.
Straight into the shallow end of a pool. And, you know, to just almost to summarize, I say alcoholic drinking by the time I was 13, kicked out of 2 high schools, and a heroin addict, IV heroin addict by the time I was 15. And, you know, early treatment, had gotten sober for a couple of years, and then ended up relapsing when I was about 18. And within about almost a 4-year relapse, it was just literal jail, in and out of institution, being homeless, you know, or sleeping in my car somewhere by my mom's house, like, you know, hoping to like wait and like steal money mm-hmm. or something like that. It was, you know, everything, I guess you could almost just say what you would picture as an alcoholic and a heroin addict. You know, it was just kind of living that life and not caring. And what you had mentioned from, it was probably somewhere either in my blog post or something that I have on my site, where I don't think, this is just kind of my understanding of how it worked in my mind, that drugs and alcohol didn't numb my pain, as a lot of people think that it numbs the pain. For me, yes, it did do that, especially alcohol, because you can black out. But what it did for me, because throughout my entire childhood, just being so full of anxiety and worry and focusing on everything around me and how I fit into that, when I was focused on getting money, getting more, getting drunk, it was just a laser focus of living that lifestyle that I didn't worry about anything else. I felt like I had a purpose, and how do I fulfill that purpose? So yeah, I don't think it numbed the pain. It only, you know, it only caused more problems.
You were just locked in, so it gave you clarity to escape everything else. But then once that kind of subsided, you were still chasing that. And then it just ended up being a circle, so that was the only place you had that laser focus and you could push everything else out.
Right. Yeah. I didn't have to, I had like succumbed to the fact that this was my life and this is all it is, and you're surviving at this point, so just keep doing it. But I was able to just laser focus on that lifestyle. And I hope someone can really relate to that, because I do. It numbed out the voices in my head, or it kind of blocked out the voices in my head of any insecurity, because, you know, the thought was always just, how do I get one more? How do I get one more? How do I make it through the day? And then when nightfall comes, it's, you know, the terror of, how am I going to do this again tomorrow? But when that is just your lifestyle, I'm sure any addict can relate to that. When that is your lifestyle, you don't know any other way. And to go to, if anyone knows this, there was a study done, and you learn about this in probably high school now, where, you know, if a rat is given, I think they did morphine, and how they will go to the morphine over anything else. And then there, you know, so that just shows, you know, physical dependence and everything else. And then there was a study done, Rat Park, where if you give the rat other things, if you put other rats in the cage and they have the connection, rarely do they actually go for the morphine bottle. They have the regular water bottle, so, and then the morphine bottle. And then you put toys in there and everything else. And if you give them something else to focus on, most of the rats didn't go for it. So it's just one of the, it's another almost example of the lifestyle of addiction. When that's all you know and you're bored,
yep,
that's what you're going to go to. There's no other stimulus
in your life. The simplest path.
Right. No other coping mechanism. So, yeah, I ended up, you know, like I said, yeah, jails, lots of institutions. And on one, I call it the fateful night, I was driving from my mom's house in the suburbs into the city, was blackout drunk, had drugs on me, and I had gotten, again, in the suburbs, and I'd gotten pulled over in her car again. And I just remember almost thinking, like, this is it. And I, blackout drunk, I had written, when they arrested me, some, like, a two-page, like, massive confession statement. It was very strange. And woke up to my parole officer showing me the letter, and I had no recollection of writing it. And, you know, sometimes the world just puts people in your path that really believe in you and want to help you. And I had this parole officer who understood. He had been with me for like three separate times of me getting out of prison. And he wanted to get me help. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to have me go back down. He knew that wasn't, you know, it wasn't going to benefit. And he fought with me for me to get treatment, because the state didn't want to give me treatment and the county didn't want to give me treatment. And he advocated for me. And I sat in jail, in county jail, basically voluntarily, when I didn't have to fight to get treatment. I knew if I got out, it was just going to be the same thing. And where that like strength or thought came from, I had this feeling like, I've got to do something different. What is 3 months out of my life? What is 6 months out of my life? And sometimes if I'm going through, you know, a massive depression, it's like just one of those things of like, just hold on for five more minutes. And looking at that, you know, that same sort of strength that I had then. And so I did. I mean, I went into a court mandated drug treatment, went to an actual, you know, treatment center, to a halfway house, to going to 12-step meetings. And, you know, since then, it's just been like an enjoyable ride of life. And stayed at a job for 10 years and until I was just said, you know what, there's got it, which is kind of how I, not kind of, it is, it's how I got into coaching, because throughout a lot of that, I still faced massive depression, bouts of depression, insecurities, just tons of self-doubt. Mm-hmm. And on the outside, I am perceived as this joyous, happy, outgoing, fun-loving, you know, younger woman in sobriety who just loves to be the life of the party, loves to throw parties, all of this other stuff. And inside, there were so many days I just felt like I was dying and I didn't fit in anywhere. I didn't fit in any community. I'd walk into a meeting and I had been there so many times with people that I knew, and I would just be gripped with anxiety of just go back into your car. I mean, I'd even be driving there and then pull in the parking lot and it's like, where does this come from? Where does this come from? The beginning of sobriety was awful. Awful, awful. 2.5 years of almost like weeks, sometimes just crying uncontrollably, not knowing where it was coming from. And there is obviously a biochemical element to that of still, you know, getting everything that
out
I had,
of your system, you know, yeah, for so long,
the rewiring of my brain, you know, for a couple of years. And then some of that is just, again, that predisposition and having a, you know, diagnosed mental illness before I ever picked up. So, and, you know, again, wanting to do this, but yeah. So just to wrap up kind of my story, I ended up leaving that job of 10 years after going through a divorce, which was one of the best things that happened to me. No, it is no offense to him in any way, shape or form. He's a really great man. But what it did for me was I learned to really stand on my own two feet. You know, I was about 10 years into sobriety. I was doing really well in my job, and I was like single and I felt empowered and I got back into a lot of social stuff with my friends and it was like, man, I can do whatever I want. And so I quit that job at 10 years to go travel and massive depression falls back in and I'm ready to commit suicide when I'm in Asia. And again, it's that lack of human connection. The lack of human connection. And through that though, I was, I had gone to a program, to a weekend workshop and met a bunch of people who were, I guess you could say, confused or suffering the way that I was, that wanted to unlock a lot of trauma, who, you know, grown adults, and not all of them were addicts. A lot of them just either had, you know, mental, you know, something with their mental health. They wanted to improve it. There was mental illness. There were addicts. And then there were just people that wanted to better themselves. And from doing that workshop and meeting other coaches and facilitators, I was like, this is what I wanted to do. Because I saw within 72 hours this drastic change in who I was and the people around me and how motivated and empowered and connected we were to each other, to ourselves, to, you know, to the universe, just everything. And I wanted to keep that going. So I stayed in touch with them and just really kind of dove into, you know, what is coaching, what is facilitating, all of this other stuff. And when I got back, it was, you know, this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. It was really knowing what that suffering is like and knowing the confusion of, you know, being in that job for 10 years and saying, man, I know there's more to life than this, but who's going to hire me with my background? I'm an addict, you know, I messed up, you know, all this stuff where it's like BS, you know, I needed a coach or a really good therapist years ago and I didn't have it, but I could have used it. And knowing what I went through, I'm like, you know what, there's so much more and we really don't give ourselves enough credit. We just need someone there just to kind of hold, you know, to hold our hand. And once I found that, it was just, you know, that's what I want to do.
And I'll use this to kind of segue into everything you've learned in the time you've been a coach and have applied it to the addiction recovery and mental health there. But you have a blog post on your website where you have three steps to overcoming shame in recovery. And so the three steps you had in there, I thought were amazing. I wrote it down here so I wouldn't forget any of them. But I mean, it just in your story there that you were just telling about, like step one was needing to forgive yourself or allowing yourself to forgive yourself. And then allowing you to rewrite your script, which you can't really do on your own all the time. You need that connection or leadership or somebody in a position of help or mentorship, coaching, to be able to help you gain perspective to be able to do that. And then also to challenge yourself weekly. So those were three steps there that I thought were amazing. And just even the aspect of shame and all of what we're talking about today is very high and very relevant, but it's not insurmountable. Like there are tools and steps and pathways to overcome that. So is there anything you want to expand on that? And then we'll jump into kind of the rest of the topics we had planned.
I think one of the top one of like forgiving yourself, that was, you know, that was almost like first and foremost of being this child who, if I didn't get 100, I'm an absolute perfectionist. And that goes way beyond my actual, you know, conscious memory of just always being this perfectionist, that the abandonment issues. If I'm not perfect, people are going to leave. Dad is going to leave. Mom's going to leave. Everyone's going to leave me. Again, having that, you know, that term to me was like, oh, okay, I understand. But learning to forgive myself. And that means that I am human just like everyone else. I am going to make mistakes. If forgiveness is one of my top values, because I can rationally and intellectually comprehend that we are all human and we're fallible. If I can do that for other people, which I'm almost like too good at sometimes, where I'm like, oh, whatever, people are just people. It's okay. I'm almost too forgiving with other people sometimes. Why can't I do that to myself? You know, saying, you know what, you have this past. You don't have like this like sparkling clean past to what most people would consider like, oh, you did everything right. But being able to say, I forgive myself for that, because from that, I have so much strength. And, you know, I've experienced a lot of crazy and sometimes cool things that happened in my addiction that people will never experience. Not saying that they want to, but I've experienced some different things. So I can forgive myself for not being like everyone else. And then, you know, rewriting the script. I'm not a huge, and I have a blog post on this and I just never put it up, and it's affirmations are bullshit. To rewrite the script, and which is why I had that in there, and it is, it's a completely separate blog topic, but rewriting that script for ourselves. And it's not just about the complete law of attraction or when I'm feeling depressed or I'm having a bad day saying, you're beautiful, you're happy, life is wonderful. You know what? If I don't believe that and I don't feel it, you know, they've done studies on, I think there's a big Canadian study on the adverse effect of positive affirmations for people that have, you know, depression or something. Because then you start having like the imposter syndrome, or it's like, oh my God, not only are you this, but you're also a liar and you can't even be honest with yourself.
Well, I think in the blog post, when you kind of downplay the effects or the desire to use affirmations in that way, like it's almost becoming a, don't use a qualitative discussion to frame this, use it as a quantitative discussion. So that if you're looking for a job and you say, oh, well, I don't have the qualifications for this, list the actual qualifications that you do have. So like list what is there as opposed to something that's just a descriptor, but list something that's concrete or, you know, verifiable or viable and or validatable to be able to do some of that stuff. And that it quickly moves away from the affirmations and you're able to see what does build you up as opposed to, like you were saying, the I'm beautiful, I'm strong, I'm intelligent type things.
Yeah. And with that, so like you were saying, like rewriting the script. So something that it would look like is that, you know, you are going for a job and say it's, you know, in a completely different career field, instead of saying, well, I have nothing that qualifies me for this job. And then we start feeling completely hopeless in that situation. And, oh, I'm never going to move out of this job. Really writing down, you know, your years of experience. What have you actually experienced? I was, you know, I know that I'm a good team player, or that I am, you know, valuable in this way. You know, I had to look at that. And one place that it came from was transitioning from the crazy intense restaurant industry into looking at, like, you know, working with a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. What skills did I already have? You know, could I say to myself, or just another example would be, like I said, my, you know, a level of honesty or forgiveness, instead of saying I am beautiful or I am this. If you know that you are, you know, honest or forgiving or whatever your values might be, you can truly say that to yourself and build off of that. We're not going from, I think I wrote it in there, it's not going from 0 to 60. It's about meeting yourself where you're actually at. And I have done this of just rewriting my script when in like my lowest points. And I've always been able to find something that I can put on there for that day. One thing my coach had me do was write my 100 successes list. Mm-hmm. You know, 100 things. It could be the, you know, the smallest thing that I won, you know, the second grade spelling bee, whatever it might be, anything small. And at first I was like, there's no way. And by the time I was at 100, it was, man, I could keep going with this. I mean, the simple things of I've gotten sober, you know, I got my license back, and not saying to myself, well, that's what you should have done anyways. It's like, no, these are my successes.
They're successes on your journey, in your story.
Right.
And that is what, again, makes you human and individual and both the same as everyone else, but also you have to define those successes for your own journey. And again, kind of going back to what you were saying before, where everything that you did over the course, I mean, that the sum of those experiences have gotten to you here. So take stock of that and then understand that not everybody had those same experiences. So somebody else's list should look completely different.
Right.
They shouldn't
right.
look exactly yeah. the same. You shouldn't have all the same boxes checked, because that's not what we want to do going through life. That's not the whole point of it.
It is. It's looking at those experiences of what are my experiences? What are my successes? And when we write those down too, noticing that's just another way to relate to other people, you know, going through a divorce. It's like, well, how is that a success? Do you consider it a success? Like, are you angry about it? You know, are you completely broke, or, you know, what happened, but you still got through it? That's a relatable mm-hmm. experience to other people, and it's yours. And no one can take that from you, which is the greatest thing about making a list like that, or, you know, rewriting your script. Again, if it's your values, no one can take that from you. So doing this exercise, instead of just kind of coming up with a cheesy affirmation, it's yours. No one's forcing
yeah,
it upon
you're
you,
able to
it's
own
not
that.
Fake.
Yeah, you're able to own that, and it gives you it gives you a momentum. It gives you the ability to keep going and wanting to kind of add to that list, as opposed to kind of searching for other things that maybe a little bit more esoteric and not really concrete or graspable.
Yeah.
So, okay. So let's jump into some of the addiction and mental health pieces. In some of the prep we had here, you had talked about why is it so hard for an addict to stay or get sober, as well as facing both active using and a mental illness in either case, and some of the conditions that are both contribute to that or the system working actively against someone kind of going through that journey, as well as you mentioned here, the adverse effects of a lot of just that experience to recovery in general.
Yeah. So for me, I hate saying like for me, but just the difficult thing, for one, the system really isn't, when someone is seeking help, the system, at least in the United States, is not set up to really, deal with this or cope with this. And I believe it's only gotten worse with some of, as people are trying to make money off of addiction. Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot of light has been brought to this because of the opioid crisis. And that's like a whole tangent I could go off on in itself.
A whole other series of blog posts.
It's a whole other series of how, it's like, you're being used by the system. You're this guinea pig. And because it has affected, the wealthy or the rich or, white collar, it's all of a sudden it's this crisis, which is not true. Well, it is true, but it's always been there.
It's not anything new.
Not anything new. And then what that has also done too, is that there's a lot of, people out there who are, trying to make money off of addiction and not the most ethical way. But even in my experience going in, so here's just an example. Say, I have I'm actively using drugs and alcohol, and attempt to take my life by overdosing on pills, right? This is a true story. And they end up sending me to the psychiatric unit at a well-known hospital in the suburbs. And they're very well equipped in this psychiatric mm-hmm. unit to kind of, just get me like nice and baseline to make sure that I won't do this again for the next 5 days because I'm, behind lock and key. But what they didn't look at was, well, did she do this because she is severely depressed and hopeless because she's been rewiring her brain chemicals and she doesn't see a way out. Mm-hmm. So in that case, it was, well, we can keep you in the psychiatric unit and maybe have a doctor come in and talk to you, but without the quick fix of something, I'm just going to go out and self-medicate yep. again. And then on the other side of that too, the worst of the two, I believe, is that you go into a detox for drug treatment or maybe even a treatment center, and they claim to have mental health treatment
resources,
and what happens is within a couple of days, maybe, or right when you get in, if it's a detox, they give you a psych eval, and that's it. And again, I will just checking boxes. In my particular case, I remember when I went into treatment, it was, oh, well, you have bipolar. And I'm just like 21-year-old snot-nosed kid, and like knowing, and luckily I knew what was in the DSM too, and knowing my symptoms here, I said, no, I don't. And I'm not going on your pill, and I'm not like it's not just because you want to check some boxes,
check that box and make it easy diagnosis,
and send me out the door and just hope that it works. I'm not doing it, and that's just one, disorder that she labeled me with. A good friend of mine who recently just got out of treatment, she went in on no medication, and walked out of an evaluation with 11 different prescriptions. In next month, it'll be 14 years. So again, a lot has changed in 14 years too, where it's here, let's just see how these interact. There's tons of addicts out there. There's mm-hmm. no shortage of people trying to get into a treatment center. Let's see what medications will work, what doesn't work. And that's why I use that term, like guinea pigs, for, the addiction community and then for the mental health community as well. And so in that case, it's, well, let's just put them on a medication and see what works. And for me, in my case, knowing that not meeting that much of the criteria for bipolar, I'm always on, have always been on the depressive side, and having been diagnosed with chronic severe depression at a young age, I was like, no, I'm not taking mm-hmm. the medication. But more times than not, someone will go in with an addiction problem into a treatment center and have the psych eval. And all they want is to feel better. So when a doctor says, well, this is what you have, Of course.
They're going to take their word for
it. Fix me. Fix me. I want anything to make me feel better at this moment. Or maybe they're hoping that they're going to get high off, you know, this combination of medicine. But really, it's wanting to look for the label. It's wanting to feel better in that moment. And you don't know how those medications are going to interact. I don't think in one evaluation you can put anyone on maybe one medication, but, you know, this cocktail of medications when someone is coming down off of, you know, years of drug and alcohol use. So that's kind of the biggest problem. Again, I don't have the complete solution to this. One of the main things is that you have more correspondence between treatment centers and doctors. And this is the one thing I really hate to say, forgive me for saying this, but with these treatment centers, more regulation, there has to be more government regulation or more government treatment facilities. And I'm, you know, kind of like anti-government in all of my stuff. But when it comes to this, if not, it is just going
there to be some sort of oversight, some sort of governance.
There has to be, you know, I had in talking to you earlier, the, you know, I called them like commission doctors, how doctors, and this was no secret some years ago, of doctors getting commission off of Suboxone. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not some conspiracy theory, like there's lawsuits against this. And so being put on all these different medications and these doctors are getting their kickbacks, you know, when does the government come in and say, these are the reasons for crime? These are the reasons for, you know, childhood abandonment because of drug use. When are we going to step in and do our duty to say, because of corporate greed, this can no longer happen because we're just creating our own problems here.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the elements that you had talked about in there, and then even when we first talked at Sip of Hope about a month ago or 2 months ago now, the notion of kind of bouncing between some treatment centers and going through and almost being like a rotating door through some of the treatment centers and just doctors wanting to get you through there as quick as possible. And you're looking for that quick fix, or you want to have participation in your recovery, but then they're checking boxes, just wanting you to move through there. And we didn't really touch on this so far, but all of what we've talked about so far in your journey, has that been in the Chicago area or Midwest? Yes. Or because when we first met and talked, there was the story you told me mirrored, I'd say, a handful of my friends who had the exact same story from all over the country and kind of in pockets of the country, but then also were bounced around to multiple different treatment centers all over the country. And these weren't just single individual stories. These were all stories that kind of started to converge to the same trends, same topics and everything. So again, like you're saying, this is your experience, but it's also one that I've had validated with just conversations with other friends that have gone through down the same road and just looking for help. And then it's just where they went to help for help first time based off of reaching out, symptoms, actions taken, then it doesn't really work for them there. So then the system just kind of moves them through and then either checks that box for bipolar and then something's not going on and then they don't know any better based on their experience. So then they just keep going on and moving into the next one. And it just, as in a handful of the situations, it just, the more they went through it, like less of their, or more of their rights were taken away, they had less of their autonomy, they had less agency as they went through the system, but it was just because nobody would listen to them. And it was kind of almost a commission-based system of just trying to get people into a certain class of diagnosis just so they can say, yeah, this is what we did, and then move on with it. So, yeah, so that's why I was interested to see if that was regionally effective or if it was like kind of correlated with a lot of the stories that I've heard from friends and loved ones of being very much a nationwide kind of issue as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, my experience here with most of it is just in the Chicagoland area, or, you know, I mean, I went to treatment like 20 years ago too, and that was down in Carbondale, but, you know, still that was long-term treatment. And, you know, another thing to look at too, and, you know, it's a lot of it is just kind of politics, but at the same time, it is, you know, getting to just to talk about this stuff and say, like, I will not be used this way. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that other people should be used this way. Is that, you know, when we look at it, the, you know, insurance, I mean, there's, again, this is so much of this is like way beyond the scope of just this conversation. You know, the first time I ever went to treatment, it was a 6-month program. And that was literally 20 years ago. It was a 6-month program. When I went to treatment 13 years ago now, that was a 3-month program. I go back to that treatment center on a monthly basis, the same one that I attended when I got sober, and it is now a 28-day program. and they are trying to get those women. I never see the same women twice, basically, because they're in and out in 28 days. And now the insurance companies, so it's a scramble. And those caseworkers, the insane thing is, it's pretty much all the same counselors that are there when I went there. These are dedicated women to helping other, you know, women mm-hmm. addicts. So, you know, what they have said is from the day they get here, almost from day one, we are trying to figure out where they're going to go next. We cannot properly give them treatment because it's always just like putting out fires of where are you going to go next? How are you going to do this? They cannot fully help them.
Yeah. Before you even take any action in there, they have to get the ball rolling because they know they're going to be out the door in 4 weeks.
Right. Well, now the insurance companies are saying, oh, well, if you can do it in 28 days, you must be able to do it in 21. And they're trying to shorten that to what we have thought of as like the traditional 28-day program. They're trying to shorten it down to 21. You know, so that there's so many things in the system that are just broken. And this whole idea of, you know, the war on drugs that was, you know, started by one man. If you want to read more about it outside of your like high school or college, Chasing the Scream by Johan Hari it's 300 pages of, it is just such a captivating book. And it is, I mean, some of the stuff you learn just a little bit about in like high school or college, and he just goes into this intense, what really is the war on drugs? So I won't go into that too much, but you know, find the book at your library. And I'm trying to look at all.
Well, it's interesting that while you look at some of your notes, it's interesting that you bring that up because that was something that Megan had brought up as well in our conversation, as far as the war on drugs and then the futility that those caseworkers would feel, which in her case, it was some of the nursing staff where they felt like they were there. They needed to do the best for them that they could while they were there, but they knew in her previous position that they weren't going to be able to kind of change the world in that situation. It was just kind of working within what you had to be able to do that and do the best you could for the person while they were there. But knowing that A, they're going to time out and go somewhere else. And then B, they may very well end up back here not too long after that for a certain number of situations. So there's an interesting parallel between that, some of the treatment centers that you're talking about, and her just from a straight out nursing hospital facility as well.
Yeah. And when you look at that too, you have so many men and women who genuinely want to help and they go into that field. And I had originally went to college to be a social worker and, you know, without even finishing my degree, I was like, this is not what I want to do. I knew that like, it's one of the highest burnout rate, looking at what your pay is compared to what student loans would have been. And, you know, also being in 12-step recovery, I'm like, that's kind of more my, it's like, what is that saying? Like, you know, politics make strange bedfellows or something like that. It's like, I didn't want to mix what the passion was to how I paid my mortgage. And I was working for a great restaurant and I said, hey, you know, is the offer still on the table to move up? Cause I knew right then I was like, it's not what I want to do. I was going to burn out way too quickly because you have so many people that are so passionate and believe in what they do. If you want to call them a bleeding heart, I say that's just what humans are supposed to do is help each other out. And there's not the funds there. There's so much red tape that, you know, they know their clients are just going to be gone and that's it. And they're probably going to see them again. And then the real sad story to that is just with a lot of healthcare workers or social service workers, police officers, whatever you want, you know, whatever you think of with that is they become jaded and hardened because of the recidivism rate. And they're just like, why would you do this? And it's not, you know, they entered into that field maybe, you know, either to save the world, but really they believed in what they were doing and the system has failed them. Mm-hmm. Not the person with the diagnosis, not the addict, but the system in itself has failed the people who want to do the most good too.
Well, it failed the people that A, need it, and B, want to work in the system to help the people that need it. So it's failed multiple facets there. So as you're talking there about the kind of the agency and advocacy of people going through this recovery journey, there's a lot there to dig into on the stigma both of and people in recovery. So why don't we transition to that next topic there? And then all of the different kind of cure-alls, all of the different ways of we mentioned it kind of kicking off as far as when someone is in recovery or still suffering in the throes of addiction, and then they pass away, like the conversation that happens then and how that is different than someone who may have never had some of that experience in their life.
Yeah. So this, it was big. There were the two things that you're talking about. One, you know, I noticed when, as I'd mentioned before, when I got sober and started being active in the 12-step community, there was still that underlying, you know, depression that I had and all of these, you know, negative thoughts and insecurities that I had about myself from childhood. So it's like, I'm battling with that. And again, I'm active in the 12-step community, so it's no knock to that. This is just my experience and the experience of a lot of other people, is that, you know, there's people are, you know, just because someone gets sober doesn't mean that they have a PhD in, they're not a psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. They're just someone else who's working the 12 steps and they're trying to get sober. And maybe they never, you know, have battled with depression. They've never gone through that, or they only went through it when it was, you know, alcohol induced or something. So, you know, I've seen it in, you know, so the people that are not hip to this, where they're like, man, I'm really battling with something. And they're like, oh, you know, just pray harder, or just mm-hmm. do this, or just, you know, work your steps harder. And or this was one of the worst things, a girlfriend of mine who had bipolar, she, you know, we were really young at the time. She had gone to kind of like one of our elders in the program, old timers, as we call them. And she was talking to him about it. And he said, you don't need that, you know, 12 steps work for everything. And she's like, what? Mm-hmm. And I was there when he had said it to her. And it's this whole idea of, you know, that either one, you're not sober if you're on medication, that, you know, mental illness, like disorders don't exist, that there are cure-alls. And that's, you know, it's not the case. And I'm not going to go in here and quote like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I could. And it goes completely against like what that man had said of, you know, there's so many little one-liners in that book of, you know, that they don't have a monopoly. They're not, you know, it's not affiliated. It encourages seeking outside help if need be. It talks about mental and emotional, you know, disorders. Like, it mentions that, you know, they understood. And the founders, you know, especially one of them, they suffered from all of this. But they had to keep it into the context of alcoholism, right? So they weren't opposed to any of this stuff. But in their actual, you know, treatment plan for alcoholism, that's what they had to focus on. And it's almost, you know, there's evangelists out there who believe that, you know, what they have heard from someone else or what they want to believe is the truth of 12-step programs. And I'm one of those, like, that's not what your book says.
Well, I find it ironic that there are people that would say that the 12 steps are the only way of going through that when, in fact, there are 12 steps, so there's more than one thing that needs to be done. So why limit it to 12? Why not 11? Why not 13? So the fact that you have that notion of there were 12 of them to begin with, so maybe there are other things outside of just the scope that we had as a practice at one time for one thing that worked well, but then again, seeking outside help and kind of going and doing some of the other things. So like, you sprain your ankle and you're doing RICE, rest, ice, compression, elevation. You break an arm, they're going to give you a shot for antibiotics. They're going to set it. They're going to wrap it in a cast, and they're going to give you something for the pain. And then the biggest thing is time to let it heal. So like, right there, there's five things too. So you're not just like getting a single cure-all. It's not one thing that happens and boom, you're done. So on the flip side, for the mental and emotional symptoms that we kind of struggle with as well, like, there's many things that can contribute to the road to recovery of those afflictions, addictions, and things like that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's not... most people that I know, especially women, you know, that are more my age, maybe some of the old timers, they don't as much, but like, you know, the millennials my age, most of us are like, oh yeah, you know, our therapist,
yeah,
you know, blah, 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 blah. Like, it's just like, you know, it's like going to see your mother for, you know, Sunday dinner or something, like, oh yeah, you know, my therapist. But it's really understanding that, you know, we do need other outside help. But, you know, my 12-step community, that is my foundation of my sobriety. And then everything else is just, you know, it's taking care of it. I believe I have this on my website too. You know, like, a girlfriend of mine is a personal trainer. It's like, I don't go to my sponsor in the 12 steps and ask her about, you know, what sets I should do for mm-hmm. the next hour. I go to a personal trainer, right? I go to meetings and meetings definitely do, like, it's my mental and my emotional health, but for any other underlying psychiatric issue, I go see a therapist. Again, for me, those issues were there before I ever picked up drugs and alcohol. For me, they are, you know, separate but very intertwined issues. So I seek help for that. You know, I do volunteer work that gets me going, of like this altruistic thing of giving back to the community. It's not just this one-stop shop. I believe it can be for a lot of people who have found, you know, a new way of life and success. I have plenty of friends that, you know, the 12 steps is, you know, or an anonymous program is the only thing that they do, and that's fine. But again, it says right in the book, like, we don't have a monopoly on this. Mm-hmm. Like, they tell us that. So, you know, one thing I wanted to touch on, but it was like in the beginning and through conversations with friends about this, you know, about like going in with a mental illness and feeling like some people don't understand that. It's like, man, you know, I get sober and now I have to deal with one more thing. And then there's the stigma with it too. Like, you know, I'm stigmatizing myself almost, that I don't want to believe that I'm so messed up that I have to face my addiction and then a mental illness. And then when I try to talk about it and I don't get some of, you know, the comfort that I need, I guess, or the answers that I'm seeking, that's where it really becomes like hopeless. Like, man, I don't even fit in among, mm-hmm. you know, these mess ups here, you know, even they don't understand me. Where am I to turn? Another issue was, you know, if I'm going through a bout of severe depression and I just don't want to shower, I don't want to do anything, I'm in the house, you know, and one of the simple things that I can do is just get to a meeting. I, you know, every time I go to one, I always feel better. But when I'm in that state, I don't want to leave the house. And that's where the really scary thing is, of, you know, really sticking to that. And there were plenty of days going through insane depression, you know, suicidal thoughts and all of this stuff sober. And it's like, just go to a meeting, just go to a meeting, just go to a meeting. But I don't want to, but I don't want to, but I don't want to, you know, again, like rewriting the script and saying, Casey, you've been here plenty of times. You can go in your pajamas. You don't have to put on makeup. You know, it's okay. And really, like, having to nurture myself. And if someone judges me, like, so what? Like, I'm here to live, like, literally actually live today.
Yeah.
And to stay sober. So there's just so many things at the beginning of, you know, misconceptions of from people in the program, you know, maybe giving like bad advice. But again, no knock to the program. It's just a group of individuals that are not, you know, licensed in this stuff. You know, for someone suffering, it's like, you don't like one meeting, you know, go to another meeting, try an online meeting. I talked to a friend about that where he couldn't leave the house. He's like, I was just doing online meetings. But then the downside to that is you're not actually having that
actual connection,
actual, you know, physical connection. There's dual diagnosed meetings out there, which is phenomenal. I think there's three really well-known programs, you know, I have two of them here, Dual Diagnose Anonymous and then Double Trouble Recovery. The other one I can't remember, but, you know, there's at least three programs out there that if you feel like you don't fit in and someone doesn't understand, you know, your diagnosed mental illness or just really wanting to focus more on your mental health and you are an addict, there are communities of people out there that truly understand that you can be open and vulnerable with.
We touched on it a couple of times, but as far as the overlap of addiction and mental health and wanting to seek treatment in either ones, but then ultimately sometimes you can't, or you can't kind of get the treatment you want. And so it ends up in the unfortunate end of completing suicide. So then what are the conversations or what are what happens afterwards in the community there as far as looking back at the individual or using the program? Does the program account for that? Does it adapt for that? What goes on after that in those circles when something like that unfortunately happens?
So this was, I think, my main reason for wanting to come here. I had a couple of friends, one woman in particular, she was about three years ago, she had passed away, and I hope everyone understands this. She had passed away, and it was, you know, that there were pills next to her, and she also, you know, she's in recovery. She had gotten married and wasn't hanging around as much, but she would, you know, show up, and you know, I knew she suffered, I believe it was bipolar. So, she was bipolar, and I couldn't help but think after, you know, after she had passed that, you know, the obituary read, you know, had, you know, died peacefully in her sleep. And then it just, it stung me to like the realization of, I didn't do everything that I could. And I know that, you know, I she was going through something that was not just alcoholism. It wasn't just recovery alcoholism. There was a mental illness, you know, it was diagnosed and we knew that. And the unfortunate thing is that when we just say, oh, well, she overdosed, the addiction recovery community says, oh, well, that's just so sad. She just didn't work her program. And then
she just couldn't stay on the train. She just couldn't stay on, right, on the trail.
Right. Because there's pills next to her. And then on the other side, if we don't say this was, or what we believe could have been, you know, that she took her own life, that it was a suicide, we aren't doing the mental health community any benefit by talking about this. And, you know, then you could go into statistics as well. So would she be labeled an overdose, or is she labeled a suicide? Or is she just labeled as someone that, you know, her heart gave out?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's why it was so important to talk about this. And that is just one example. I mean, I have, you know, other friends. Hers was the one that hit me the, you know, the hardest, I believe, 3 years ago. And, you know, but so many friends along those lines where you see them coming, you know, not necessarily just in and out of meetings and relapse, but they'll go to meetings and then they kind of back off and they're, you know, their depression has kicked in, or their bipolar isn't, you know, they're not as stable right then. And they're scared to ask for help because that's what we are. Mm-hmm. You know, we're scared, you know, we don't want to be looked at as weak or labeled as, oh, you know, you're not working your program hard enough, or to someone that doesn't know, then you start getting into all the other labels that we might have of someone who's facing a mental health condition.
Well, so like exactly that stigma that you said, that it's like, oh, well, it worked for this person, it should work for everybody else, so let's just keep, right, getting into it and then you'll be fine, as opposed to there could be other things that are going unaddressed that need to be addressed, and that could make the program easier on you to supplement it with other discussion, conversation, treatment type discussions.
Yeah. So, you know, and with that, and I feel like I cannot stress enough that when we don't address these, when we don't address both sides of the issue of the addiction recovery and, you know, mental health, when we don't address them together in some way, we do a disservice to both communities. Again, how do we define how she passed, and how do we look at her as someone that was, you know, just like anyone with, you know, suicide, is that, you know, they were weak, they couldn't get it, why didn't they ask for help? And then, you know, I'm on the other side, like, oh my, what could I have done? Mm-hmm. What could I have done? And, but we're not doing either community any benefit by, you know, somehow not integrating and saying, enough is enough with this. You know, we're all in this together here. And I really think that, you know, we're not honoring the person that has passed, and we're not honoring what they were going through, that they were, when I think of when I'm going through, it is torture. It is absolutely, it's the prison of my mind. I have physically been in prison, and there is no worse prison than the prison of my mind when I am going through a bout of depression. And when I think of what it must take to get to that point, to, you know, who knows, maybe she didn't want to feel anymore. And mm-hmm. she said, I just want to go to bed. And she took the, you know, the cocktail of pills that took her life. But it, you know, there's so many unanswered questions with these things, but really just starting that conversation. And I think some of it really has to start with the addiction community, the recovery community, saying, hey, we're really gonna open our eyes to this, because we are losing people, and it's not just an overdose. They were battling with depression, they were battling with something else, and they didn't want to get high, they didn't want to get drunk, mm-hmm. they just wanted to stop that right then.
The point you made about we're all in this together is one that really hits home, because that's as we're recording here at the Hope for the Day offices, a conversation I've had with Johnny Boucher, the founder of Hope for the Day, many times, where he says the exact same thing in the mental health discussion. And the mental health territory and organizations tend to be very territorial and tribal, and there's a lot of politics in and of itself inside there. So you're doing a disservice to the community when, as providers and resource givers and just community members, you're kind of sectioning things off and kind of separating it out. So if to have the mental health community stand and kind of point fingers over to the recovery community or vice versa, like, it does a disservice to everyone involved if that's the case. So when we've realized that we are in this together and bring everybody together to have that conversation, to bring resources and treat it as a holistic whole, that's going to be better for everybody. And then maybe being able to treat some of that in a way and understanding that is going to help with not needing to get people out in 28 to now to 21 days, but understanding that there are other ways to treat some of this stuff, and then kind of going through the mental health treatment centers as well as a 12-step program combined in unison would be better than just seeing somebody kind of kicking them out and then being back a week later type thing. That really hit home and really makes sense there as far as the note I took, that you do a disservice to both when you don't address them in unison.
Yeah, and even, you know, some kind of simple things that you can look up, but saying, well, you check this box as an addict, and, you know, you check this box as a mental, you know, a diagnosis over here, and the two of you don't go together. It's like, you are more, you know, I didn't really want to go into statistics, but it's like, if you have a, you know, there's a predisposition. If you have a, you know, any criteria for like a mental illness, what did I even have? It's like you're 60% more likely at a younger age. And then as adults too, if you have one, you're 50% more likely to have the other, and vice versa. So if you are if you're an active addiction, you know, you're 50% more likely to have, you know, a diagnosable mental illness. And then if you have a diagnosable mental illness, you are 50% more likely to have meeting the criteria for addiction as well. You know, so looking at that too, and, you know, you kind of like the sports thing, if you have an injury, when you look at our sports players, sports are always like great analogies, right? That they have an entire team of doctors and coaches behind them. I'm like, you have a third base coach. Yeah. Like, do you really, like, you have a coach for that base, right? Like, you know, looking at that too, why aren't we treating our emotional and mental health that way? Where it's like, we have an entire team of doctors that go through this. I mean, if you say you, you know, you're going in, there's some weird, you know, undiagnosable illness that you have, and all of a sudden it comes up, and now you're on 60 Minutes, and you hear about this crazy team of doctors that they had for all of this. Like, why don't we have that same team of doctors for, you know, for mental health and addiction as well? And what was the one thing that, something I had written down here too, and I can't really remember. Oh, here in Chicago, they're at Mount Sinai.
Okay.
This was maybe about a month ago, maybe it was a couple months ago, they opened up a wing, basically. It might actually be almost a standalone building, but it was like a 32 bed. It's basically triage for someone that is coming in with any sort of behavioral health services, like needs. Because if you go into the ER and you're having, you know, and you're suicidal, they don't know what to do with you, especially at Mount Sinai. They don't know what to do with you. So this facility is like, you know, the triage of behavioral and mental health services that we just opened up here. And it's, you know, I remember someone had commented like, oh, you know, only 32 beds. It's like, this is just the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, let's take what we can get. And like that is like the beginning of medicine right there, where you have the team of doctors, the entire crew ready to go, that are all working together hand in hand. You know, we definitely need more of those. I believe there's one pretty similar up in the Twin Cities too. So it's like, as we start to see this happening more and more, And hopefully we realize not just, you know, we realize like the actual cost to our country, like the dollar amount that we are putting into this. And that's just one, you know, aspect. It's about our own physical safety, you know, crime issues, all this other stuff that it's like, we're only hurting ourselves. And hopefully our government starts to realize that.
So let's start to transition to the last topic that we wanted to talk about here. And it's one I'm very interested in based off of being someone in kind of the larger corporate world for 15 years and having pretty much everything you've talked about here in seeing some of that represented in, or what we're about to talk about here is seeing that represented in normal in air quotes, conversations, experiences, and things across that time through many different organizations, leadership styles, management change, things like that. But the notion of stigma in the workplace and everything that we're talking about there, where I'm a pretty big advocate, obviously, of mental health with the podcast. And so bringing that into the workplace has been a real eye-opener, because since that time, I've had numerous colleagues, numerous friends, numerous peers that I've worked in, even other people that I haven't worked with on a daily basis or on my team, but have reached out to connect and understand and kind of discuss some of that, and never felt that they could share that with anyone in a professional setting, because then they would go back to imposter syndrome, feeling like they weren't worthy and some of that stuff for where they were. So I'm interested to get some of your discussion here as far as like your experience in starting that conversation around stigma in the workplace, and then some of the other topics that you had said to kind of touch under this.
Yeah, so the stigma in the workplace, you know, noticing from my own experience at that, you know, with the company that I was with, and it could have been any company, to be honest, still feeling there's the stigma of the addiction, even though I had been in recovery. It was, you know, what if they find out about me? They're not going to trust me. This was a big one of mine. If I show up late to work, they're going to think I was drunk. I didn't call in sick. I don't think I ever really called in sick. I was probably about 9 years after working at that company. I had no voice, and my boss actually came in and sent me home. Mm-hmm. I was too scared to take a sick day for fear that someone would think I was drunk or that I was messing up. Again, part of that might have to do with like my perfection of how people view me, but I was always worried that someone's going to think I messed up. And, you know, but then there's like Samantha over there who shows up to work drunk. Like, why was that acceptable? And, you know, and looking at that. So I think it's a huge thing for people that are in recovery. And there's this battle almost of, I'm an open book. I'm going to tell my job everything. I have nothing to hide. I was always against that because, it's, you know, for one, I don't think everyone really needs to know my business. I don't, you know, you want to judge me for who I am today. Don't judge me on what I have told you about my past, because I'm not an active addiction anymore. I'm not drinking a bottle a day and I'm not shooting $100 worth of heroin a day. You don't know that person. So judge me for who I am. But there's still just that the things surrounding it, and it doesn't allow, again, the connection. It doesn't allow us to make true connections with our employees to find out what their values are. If they feel like they're always hiding something from their, you know, their boss or their employer, they are less likely to express creative ideas.
1,000%. I can't agree with this enough, so keep going.
Yeah, they're afraid to express creative ideas. They're probably almost, if someone isn't, you know, if they are having, you know, if they need like a mental health day and they don't take that, then they show up to work, they're not focused, they're not productive, you know, they might be a little bit on edge, and then they get labeled from a coworker as something that they're not, you know, she's a jerk, he's an ass, whatever, why does she always act like that? Maybe they really have something going on at home. Maybe they need to go see their therapist, you know, whatever it might be. It doesn't allow someone to truly show their who they are, which is what we're all trying to be. You know, these, you know, companies nowadays talk about their company culture and how great it is. They want you to be, if this is your company, open your ears. They want you to be a part of that company culture as long as it fits into their box.
As long they want you to fit to the company culture they've already predefined.
Exactly.
To come into and check all those boxes and sit down and there's a notion that corporate culture or company culture is inorganic and rigid and that it's set to be there, where in reality it has to be fluid or else it's not a culture. It's just that's what you're writing down as far as rules, and those are completely different.
Yeah, there. So what's the example I was going to give here? And so this is it's probably one of the worst times I ever wanted to drink while I was in sobriety. You know, the company that I had worked for, we really boasted like great company culture. And I would say in the restaurant industry, comparatively, we did have really good company culture, but it's, you know, it's still corporate. It's still a restaurant. Let's just be honest. And I was transferred to a store. We, you know, you move around a lot. I was transferred to a store. I had let go of a bunch of employees that were drinking. I mean, would show up to work drunk, were doing drugs there. And I'm like, this is not the company culture. And you're gone. I don't know who your previous manager was, but it was not me. You're gone. And I had hired a bunch of people. And the way that I always say is that I hire genuinely good people. I don't care what you look like, what your past is. And you get that with people almost right away when you sit down and interview with them. And I remember, and we were like just cranking great. They may not have been the fastest or anything like that, but they wanted to be there. They wanted to work and they loved doing what they were doing. You can't teach people that. You can teach them a lot of things. Mm-hmm. You can't teach them that. And I remember my boss had brought me upstairs, like into you know, the conference room. And he had kind of ridiculed me, or, you know, he didn't care for my hiring choices. And it stung because I said, you know, because they're not blonde and bubbly and this and this and this, and it doesn't fit your criteria of the culture of the, you know, the clientele that you're trying to attract. I said, I hire genuinely good people that want, you know, that want to be here. And it stung because I felt like, you know, like they were my family and that he was questioning those decisions and that this company really wasn't what I thought it was. And those people were allowed to be individuals. They were allowed to show their creative side. They felt that they could come to me as their boss and say anything about improving or how they were feeling that day. And you know what? And they showed up to work every day on time. Why? Because you are truly creating that company culture of just be yourself. I hired you because
of who you are,
by
who,
you know, not because of your skill or how you look or anything else, but because you value certain things. And those are like really what we should be looking at. And you know what happens with that when it comes down to the actual cost of running a business, when you have those people on board, yes, they're way more creative. They're way more open and honest with you. They want to be there. The service industry, and that can be anything like retail, so much money is spent on training employees. One employee we figured just to like hire them was $1,000. Imagine you're turning over 50 employees, or let's just say 30 employees in one restaurant, one location. Mm-hmm. You're throwing $30,000 away times 20 plus restaurants. And I'm just giving you those examples because those, you know, it's the industry that I know. If you could really sit down and not care about someone's looks, their background, skills, think about what they genuinely inherently already have. And I'm not saying that those people are like really the easiest to find, but when you can find them, appreciate them. This was a team that I was able to open up with about my own emotional stuff. And then when they saw me being vulnerable, it allowed them to be vulnerable. You know, that's really what we're looking for. You could even say, you know, in larger, like a marketing corporation, having diverse talent, that means women of color. That means, you know, someone that has a background in addiction, someone that has a background, and I'm not just talking scholarly, like, you know, they have a degree and they're not like an addictionologist, but someone that has that because their view of what is needed or wanted by the market is going to be so much greater. You know, make sure to diversify your teams and appreciate them for their individuality and empower them to say, hey, this is my past. This is how I want to use it. And I know a lot of other people are out there like that. And our Western culture is very strange that the more we try to be individuals, the more we label ourselves. And that's how corporations view us, and we feed into that.
Well, that's what, the way you said it there, as far as diversifying, it's diversifying not just on the visible spectrum, which is generally what you're doing when you're checking boxes on a hiring form or a job application, but diversifying on the lived experiences, because putting that all together is where you end up getting that, as opposed to just breaking it down into labels. But like you said, when you have experiences that are different from the other members of your team, you're able to bring that vulnerability to the table, and then everybody working together is able to do that, and be that's where you end up being the sum is greater than the parts of the whole type thing, because you're able to all come together and build each other up and compensate for each other and just be a really flexible, really productive team, as opposed to, well, no, like there's just something way back then that they didn't fit, so they're gone type thing. So yeah, I jive with that 100%.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different industries that you could say, and look at the insurance companies are a big one that really like to talk about mental health and addiction too, because they're working in insurance, you know, it's how they make or lose their money is by these policies. So they actually, I'd say for the most part, they're fairly well about, they do fairly well with informing themselves with these and hopefully having, diverse, either candidates on the table or a diverse group of employees. And when they look at that, it's, who is higher risk, who is lower risk? And they really try to inform themselves. Some of the larger companies with, having like a yoga room, or, now you have, a mental health day, and fully understanding that this is what they need. Insurance companies where you check the box, like, yes, I'm actually signed up at a gym, or yes, I do see a therapist. There's some, you should be lowering someone's insurance premium if they're checking all of those boxes, looking at those things of what can, insurance companies are great. What can we do? They're really not great, but they're great at looking at, what can we do to lower that bottom line? More people are going to want to sign up with us because there's more perks if they do. And in actuality, it makes us more money because they're doing this. Those are some examples of what some companies are doing. And how many other companies out there, no, I don't care what the industry is, but to really diversify, and you're not going to get some of these ideas unless you have people from different, racial backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, again, because their perception of what, not just their perception, but their experiences in the past are going to be different, and they could be like, the $1 billion idea.
Well, their experiences in the past are obviously going to inform their everyday practices. And if they don't have that experience to get the new idea, you're just going to get more of the same if you keep hiring the same people. I mean, obviously, like, one of the kind of, it goes towards the affirmation side, but it's like nothing changes if nothing changes type thing. So like, unless you start bringing other people with different backgrounds in, you're not going to have any new conversations, new ideas, or anything like that. So that makes a lot of sense. So
I was gonna say, it's funny that you said that, when you look and you're like, well, if nothing changes, nothing changes. And then it's like, I hate to make it like the political thing, but it's like, you look at the, you look at politics, and it's like, they all look the same. They're all just like a bunch of, old white men. Like, what do you know about my insurance policy? You know nothing about it. What do you know about my birth control? What do you know about my addiction? What do you know about going to war? What do you know about my mental health? You know nothing about that. And you are the policymaker here. And again, to that, it's diversifying the pool there. But until that changes, nothing's going to change.
Unfortunately. So as we start to wrap up here, we ask a couple of questions of every episode, but what is one thing you'd want someone to take away from your story?
Oh, from my story, man, this goes to the last thing that's on that blog post, do one thing different, just like, I hate to keep trying, just do different things, get outside of the house. I never knew that there was a world out there. I never knew that there were people that felt the way that I did, that there was that, that like diagnosis for me, until I actually sought out help, until I started talking to people that would break me out of the isolation. So for anyone listening that, you know, the one thing to take from my story is no matter what the pain is at that moment, there's always something on the other side of that. We just really have to seek it. And no one knows that we're hurting until we tell them that we're hurting. Mm-hmm. And we don't find those people until we get outside of the house. As difficult as that can be sometimes, you know, for me, it was just like, I never gave up. When they told me, you know, you're not going to get drug court. I was like, hell, I'm not. I'm an addict and I deserve treatment and I'm going to fight for it. And people thought I was crazy for sitting in jail voluntarily for 6 months, but it was something I believed in. And it was, I would say, until the last door closes in my face, I'm not going to stop fighting for this, because for that little glimmer of hope of like believing I'm worthy and, you know, find some of that worth if you can. I would also say, and this was kind of on my notes, that, you know, having discussions about your mental health or your mental well-being, if it is a mental illness, like diagnosed, talking about that. And if someone brushes you aside because they don't understand, there are literally millions of people out there that do. Again, get out of the house and find those people. And what I had written in my notes from having conversations with bankers and business people, I'd say like, oh, you know, I know this sounds like a depressing conversation to talk about mental health. And really, it's not a depressing conversation. It is a conversation of hope. It is a conversation of empowerment, of showing someone, I want to talk about this because I want to be a better person. Mm-hmm. There is nothing wrong with that. There should not be, and I, you know, there isn't really a stigma around wanting to be a better person. It's just attaching like, hey, it's my mental health to it. This is a very empowering conversation.
Exactly. And I love that there's no stigma around wanting to be a better person. So if that's definitely a pull quote for the episode, that's a great one. And then the final one, you can think about this while you're taking a drink, but the final one being, we've put season-long playlists up on Spotify for all the different episodes, so folks can contribute songs that mean a lot to them, be it a self-care song, which we didn't really touch on self-care, but that can be a future topic, or something like a song that's explicative of your journey, or just one like you favorite jam out to, or anything. So if there's like one or two songs that you could share with the listening audience, what would they be?
This is like the toughest question ever. I have two, like my two big go-tos. One, John Lennon, Imagine. It makes me cry. That's like the big dreamer song right there, and I think understandably so. And then Stevie Wonder, Master Blaster. That is the empowerment song of you will make a change. There's more to this world than you will ever know. And you know, you didn't know that you would be jamming to the Master Blaster, and it's the get up and feel good song, the dance song. And there is a he's not well known at all, an Australian indie artist, Mark Wilkinson.
Okay.
He just singer songwriter, and I would listen to his stuff over and over again. One song in particular, All I Ever Wanted. And I would listen to that song every day when I contemplated, you know, am I really leaving the country? Am I really leaving my job? And there's so many lines in that song that just, there's my favorite line is, you tell me I'm here, you say I'll survive, but I'm looking for more to know that I'm alive. And, you know, it's, you know, more than just a shadow in the fading sun. It's just all these like little lines that he has in there. And he has songs about suicide and depression as well, which is, I believe, one of the most talented songwriters I've met him before.
Oh, wow. Nice.
That I've musically have ever been introduced to. And I would, but this song right here, I want to actually do a video about sobriety to that song. And just really, you know, I know that there's more to life, and I believe it is my duty. It's not just going to like fall from the sky and hit me on the head. I need to seek that out. I believe that it's there. It is my duty to seek that out. And then it is my duty to pass that along to other people. And it's kind of what that song in his music video is about, of just, of not settling. You know, I don't want to just be here. I want to know, truly know that there's more to this, that I am truly, truly alive.
That's awesome. So, I mean, this has been a pleasure. I mean, I'm very thankful we can make it happen. And like you said, there's everything that we wanted to cover here today. We've run longer than I expected to, but then there's still plenty more we could talk about, whether or not we have you back on Conversations Cafe at Sip of Hope anytime soon, or we have you back for part two of this conversation. This has been a blast. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was there anything you wanted to say before we wrap up?
Get out of the house. Talk and feel the connection. It's what life is all about, is just connecting with other people.
Awesome. Thank you. This has been great.
Thank you so very much for joining us this week. We hope you had as good a time listening as we had recording the interview. Don't forget to check out anthologiesofhope.com/playlist for all the awesome songs that will get added each week. You can find us on social media at Anthologies of Hope on Facebook and Instagram, and Anthologies Pod on Twitter. It would be great if you could subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google, and leave us a review. As always, remember, everyone has a story, and it's about time we start listening.